Hey Podnuts, Corey here from Instant House Call. Whether you're a break fix tech who needs to provide remote support on demand without pre-installed software, or a managed service provider who wants to connect to unattended PCs anytime, Instant House Call makes remote support easy. I want to invite you to try Instant House Call free for yourself. Go to podnuts.com and click on the link in the show notes, then use the promo code PODNUTS. Instant House Call is the best remote support on earth. We can prove it. Try it free now and see for yourself.
Welcome to Podnuts Daily, episode number 441, a show for computer repair techs by computer repair techs. I'm your host, Jeff Allish. I'm joined today by John Hance from computerpros.net. How you doing, John?
Hey, Jeff, doing well. How's it going?
It is going excellent. Are you ready to talk some tech type things?
Yeah, let's try.
Okay. So if you want, go ahead and give us a little bit of background and let us know how you got started in computer repair and, you know, kind of what you do nowadays.
Okay. Well, like everybody else on this show, I've always been the guy that, fixed things for friends and family and whatnot. I'm only 25, so I might be one of the younger guys you've had on here.
Yeah, probably.
Probably, yeah. I got my first job kind of apprenticing, interning back in 2009 with a small one-man computer repair shop. He kind of took me under his wing right out of high school. And I worked there for about 2 years or so going through college. And then I was one of the lucky few to, nab a job while I was still in college with Computer Pros back in 2012. And I've been there ever since. So okay. I've got 5 or 6 years of hard-earned experience under my belt.
Nice. Now, what did you go to college for?
I've got an associate's in computer science from community college, and then a bachelor's in information technology from another school around here.
Now, let me ask you a question. Now, did either one of those help you with the things that you do on a regular daily basis?
No, not on a daily basis, no. They were good for some of the foundational things and to kind of broaden maybe some of the things, you know, as far as programming and that sort of stuff. But on a daily basis, no, most of it hardware-wise, I was already familiar with before I went to school. So
okay. No, yeah. That's fair enough. So, okay. So you started working for computerpros.net, you said in what, 2009?
2012.
2012. Okay. So 2012. And, you know, and you were working somewhere before that. Okay. So now what types of things? Now I noticed you guys got three locations where right. You're at and where are the three locations? Where you, what state are you in?
We're in Tennessee, East Tennessee.
Okay.
But one of our locations is actually in Southwest Virginia. So we're right on the border of North Carolina, Tennessee and, Virginia.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah. Two in Tennessee and then one in Virginia. Very cool. So right. Now what types of things do you guys do in your business as far as, I mean, obviously with all these different locations, obviously there's different workers that work at each of these locations and, you know, people probably have their specialties and do certain things.
Yeah, we do. We do everything from mobile devices, phones, tablets, that kind of stuff. And we've got one or two guys for that, not I pick and choose a few of those jobs here and there, all the way up to full-on managed service for small to medium business. That's where my focus primarily is in my branch.
Okay.
We have another branch here in Tennessee that specializes more on electronics repair, televisions and USB jacks and all the common things that break, you know, that you might find in your house. We fix all that stuff also.
Okay, that's interesting. So now, are you fine? Because I every once in a while, probably a few times a year, I get calls for television repair, and I'm like, no, they're so different. Not, you know, it's not that they're, it's just there's so many different brands and stuff that I just don't want to tear into those to figure out, you know, if a board is bad or if there's a power switch that, you know, needs to be replaced or whatever. So, I mean, are there a lot of people getting their TVs repaired nowadays?
There are a surprising amount of people, questioning us about that. I don't really get it personally. TVs seem cheap enough that you would just go buy a new one, but we have a guy that's done it for a long time, and you know, we do LCDs, plasmas, LEDs. We don't do the rear projections simply for space reasons, but yeah, we do it on a flat rate actually. So, you know, we kind of charge depending on the size of the TV, and we've made it work. You know, most TV parts are approximately the same price. So I will say that I don't think it's the most profitable venture. I think it's just something that we decided to add to our portfolio since we did have someone that could do it.
Okay.
So if we lost him, I don't think that we would continue doing it. You know, it's more of a pain than it's worth, probably, but it is something that we do.
But, you know, the nice thing about it, if you've got people coming there for their television, which obviously not, you know, everybody's got one, and they're also going to have other electronic devices, whether it be, you know, computers or tablets or phones, they're also going to come to you for that stuff, too. So it's kind of nice to have everything under one roof. What types of jobs do you do with the television repair? I mean, are you replacing screens, boards, switches? I mean, what are most of the breakdowns as far as TVs go?
Generally, anything but a broken screen.
You okay.
know, replacing a panel in a TV is hands down not worth it.
Gotcha.
Okay. Sourcing the parts and on the labor and all that. But yes, a lot of the TVs are pretty simple. There's three or four boards. You know, you can go in there with a multimeter and, you know, within a few minutes diagnose what the problem probably is. And then a little bit of Googling, and the guy that does it for us seems to have a pretty good hand on, you know, what the common problems are. So
okay.
Generally, it's just electronic stuff.
That's great. Now is he doing board level repair, or is he are you just finding out which board is bad and basically replacing that board to get it back up and running?
He'll do full on board level repair when necessary, but
okay.
A lot of times it's more cost effective to replace an entire board than it is to do a board level repair, depending on what the part is. And TV parts are fairly cheap for what you get. So, you know, you can buy a lot of those from different websites online. And he's got a gigantic inventory of used TV parts, and he catalogs everything. So,
oh, gotcha. No, that's a great idea. Okay, very cool. Yeah.
Yep. So it's not really my interest, but it's something that our company offers. So we'd like to get that out there.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, you mentioned mobile stuff and things like that, and you know how I feel about those.
Yeah, I think you've said a bad word or two about those.
Yeah. It's just not. I know I probably need to get into it. I just cannot bring myself to do it. It doesn't seem like an area that would interest me. I guess if I had somebody who was doing it full time and that's all they did, and they're just, you know, they're constantly turning these things out, I guess it would be different. But, you know, when I pull in something like that, like a mobile device or a digitizer screen on a tablet, you know, I've got to sit there and it's going to take me a good half hour, even if I'm really good at it, to get the screen off, get it all cleaned up and, you know, get everything ready to go. And because I don't do it all the time, it's just, to me, it's not worth it for what I do. But I can understand that, you know what, these things are breaking all the time and people need them fixed. You got to have somebody that's in the area that can fix them.
And the way we do this, we have a pretty nice setup. I've got a list of devices that we will repair, and we generally keep parts in stock for. And it's all the common phones, the iPhone, from the iPhone 4 up to the 6S. I keep all of the digitizers in different colors in stock. We'll keep some of the other stuff, like the Lightning ports and stuff of that nature. And then from Samsung, anything from the S3 all the way up to the Note 3. We try to keep most of those in stock. And we've got a really good relationship with Verizon. There's a Verizon corporate store in our town. And they send all of their broken devices to us. So that nice. Referral makes it really easy to, you know, if you've got the parts in stock, you can make a pretty decent amount of money pretty quickly like that.
That's great. No, that's a great idea. Okay.
It takes a little capital to keep all that stuff in the store. And then eventually you do get a bad part here and there. So there's a little bit of inefficiency and a little bit of loss there. But, you know, for the rates, we try to be fair with the rates. And a lot of times the repair is cheaper than what the insurance deductible is. So even people that pay the insurance will have us do the job just to save, you know, a little bit of money.
Wow. I remember somebody telling me that a lot of times the insurance on that stuff is like still $100 or something like that.
Yeah. The last few customers I've had come in said their deductible was about 150.
Oh my. Okay. That's even higher than what I thought. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I haven't fact checked that. I don't know if that's true. It seems like it could be true, but you know, even if it's in the 100 to 150 range, a lot of people have pictures and things on these phones, and then if it's within reason, you know, within $10 or $20, they'd rather keep their phone than send it off and get a refurb unit.
Oh yeah. So, how many people are actually backing up their photos using, you know, if it's an Android phone using Google, or if it's a Apple phone using iCloud or whatever?
Oh, not a single one.
Isn't that sad? Those
nobody that comes in.
They're right there and you can use them, but it's like, I have to grab people's phones and go, hey, I'm going to turn this on for you.
Yeah.
We're going to back your, you know, it's free. You know what? That way, if something happens to these, at least you got some form of your pictures that you've been taking on your phone this whole time.
Yeah, no, there's no reason not to do that. The problem that we run into is people don't know their iCloud password, or they hit the 5 gig limit and then they don't want to pay for more. So they've got some of them, but they don't have the last 2 years worth. So, you know, repairing the phones, that's pretty good business for us.
Okay.
Especially the iPhones, because they're, once you do one, you've pretty much done them all. And when you keep, you know, a handful of parts in stock, it's no problem to get one in and out in a half hour. So
I probably should take a, you know, I heard, you know, if you get it like an iPhone, especially the iPhone 5s and the 6s, they're fairly easy to work on. I was told that the iPhone 4 is, you know, you've got to basically pull the whole thing apart to get to the screen on that particular model.
Yeah. Yeah. And the 4s now you can buy a used one on eBay for $40, $50. They don't really make much sense to fix. But the 5s and the 5C and the 5S, it's definitely economically feasible to fix those. And, you know, from start to finish, I can do one now in probably 12 to 15 minutes. I've probably done, you know, at least 50 or 60 of those myself, you know, just me. So we do a lot of iPhones.
All right. One of these days I'm going to get an old iPhone and play around with it.
Yeah, I've actually got a 5S that we fried that I could send up to you.
There you go. Yeah. I can see how it comes apart.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I hear, you know, I've heard people say, you know, they'll set up the digitizer and screen and kind of prefab all that kind of stuff. And they basically, they're pulling the phone apart and swapping a part out and boom, and they're done, you know, instead of messing around with, you know, each and every single component. Because that's a problem I found when I took apart, you know, and I had a bad experience with an iPod Touch.
No, me too.
And, I, you know, when I pulled it apart and I broke the strips for the volume buttons and then I broke the power button strip and it was just terrible. So I'm like, I just don't want to do this anymore, you know, but I'm hearing the iPhones with the screws and stuff like that are not quite the same type of thing.
Yeah, don't let the iPod scare you off. Those are miserable. And the iPads are pretty bad too with all the adhesive and all that garbage they use. But the iPhones, we used to be able to buy them with the front camera and the speaker and everything pre-attached. So it was really the 6 screws and then 3 ribbon cables and you were done. It was a 5-minute job.
Okay.
But I've noticed that those are really kind of hard to find nowadays. And all the screens are kind of going up in price. So
are they? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So now we have to swap over the camera and everything from the original screen, you know, assuming it's not damaged.
Well, you know, I've heard a couple people that, you know, even in the past, you know, year or so, that they'll basically buy all the parts and they'll pre-put all that stuff together instead of swapping the stuff over just because it saves them time on the repair. So they'll kind of build these things up ready to go, you know,
that's
just,
a good idea. Yeah.
You know, buying the separate parts, which I thought so too. I'm like going, yeah, because if you can spend 5-6 minutes and that's saving you, you know, the extra 6 or 7 minutes that it, you know, on top of that, it might be well worth it. You can turn around and, you know, give it back to the customer and then maybe take their, you know, camera parts or whatever, if they're good, and put that into another digitizer and screen.
Yeah, just refurbish it.
Yep.
Yeah. So, that's a good idea, but you really have to have the time and the want to do that. Where, you know, my shop is fairly small. We've only got five or six people. So none of us really have the time to sit there and refurb old phone screens. But
Right. Yeah. Well, you say small, but that's a pretty decent sized shop, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I guess so in the grand scheme. Yeah.
So yeah, all right, very cool. So you guys work on the mobile devices, and then you talked about tablets. Obviously, you guys do tablets.
A few, mainly just iPads. We'll do a few Samsungs, but beyond that, we don't fool with them too much.
And that's the other thing I can't figure out for the life of me. It's like, why would you buy this beautiful device and then you don't put a $20 case on it?
I know.
And then you come in and
you're preaching to the choir. Yeah.
it's crazy. So as far as the iPads and stuff go, you know, I had it. Now the problem I'm running into is people are starting to get these touchscreen laptops, right? So I can't do my normal 10-minute screen repair anymore. You know, I've got to get in there and now I've got to either turn the job down or figure out a way to get the digitizer off, which again, depending on the type of adhesive XYZ company is using, it's different for every one of them that I've touched so far. So,
yeah, we've had a few of those come in, and every job is different. So those are always a pain in the neck. I kind of treat them usually like MacBooks. You know, on a MacBook with a bad screen, you don't replace the screen. You just go online and buy the entire top of the computer and bolt it in, and it's a 10-minute job. So usually, if the parts are available, we'll go that route. You know, assuming that it's cost effective. But we've noticed a lot of these touchscreen laptops are $200 to $400, and at that price range, it's, you know, we have a full showroom full of new and used equipment. So at that point, when a job gets that expensive, we'll take it in as trade, you know, use the parts when we can, and then sell them a different device and transfer their data for them.
Okay.
So it's sort of it's a quicker process for us, and it's more or less painful for the customer. So I haven't had to do too many of those, you know, like you say that you had an HP, I think, with the digitizer that gave you a lot of trouble. Yeah. So those just don't seem to be worth the time, honestly.
Yeah. And, you know, in the customers, I'm trying to remember what they spent. Well, I messed up the screen, so that was my problem. But, I didn't make hardly any money on it. But okay. I think they still ended up spending like $179 to replace that.
Yeah, that's not bad. You know, most laptops on a screen replacement, if it's a non-touch screen, we charge anywhere from $100 to $150, depending on the part. So,
okay.
Yeah, a touch screen, you know, would be more than that.
Well, and that's funny. Yeah, because I do a laptop screen repair, you know, the laptop screen repairs for like $150, $149.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the screens, depending on the type of screen, they're anywhere between, you know, $50 and you know, $70 usually.
Yeah.
Some that are higher resolution or whatever, they might kind of get close to the 100-hour range, but for the most part.
I haven't seen one more than 70 or so in quite a while now. Now, back a few years ago when they were the compact fluorescent, those were a little more expensive and they were a little more of a pain with the inverters and everything.
But oh, yeah.
Nowadays, you know, everything is almost the same screen. You know, we keep a couple of the 15.6-inch panels in stock. So when we get the average generic, you know, laptop in, we can get that out same day.
Yeah, there's a couple of resources that people have given me over the last, you know, few months that I still haven't had a chance to check into. But the next time I get a screen repair, I'm going to go ahead and I think one of them was Etex, I think was the list. But and then there's a couple on Amazon. Mm-hmm. But I'll order a couple screens and get those in and, you know, just see if it's going to work for some of the generic models out there. Cause I do see a lot of the same things, you know, you're going to see a lot of Toshibas, a lot of Acers, a lot of, you know, you'll get, you know, I look at higher end stuff like HP, Dell, you know, stuff like that. But really you look at the backs of a lot of these screens and a lot of them are so similar, even as far as numbers.
Oh yeah.
There's
only a couple of big manufacturers for those panels.
Right.
And then I think they're down to probably three or four major manufacturers now. And with everything being LED, most of the connectors are on the same side. So, you know, if you keep one of each in stock, you can pretty much do any 15-inch laptop.
That's a good idea. Yeah, you know, and I've never thought about that. You're right. It is usually on one side or the other. Probably been a handful I've seen that are like directly in the center for whatever reason. But yeah, most of the time, you're right. It's right or left. So
yeah. So those are pretty easy. I recently just had a screen repair go bad. It wasn't even meant to be a screen repair. I was putting a new hard drive into a 2011 iMac, and my mistake, you know, I had the suction cup there to take the glass off, and I had the job all finished up and putting the glass back on, and sure enough, it slid right out the suction cup and cut my hand pretty well, and smashed that $100 piece of glass.
Yeah.
So that was an inadvertent screen repair. Yeah, so everyone, you know, accidents happen. So that was actually my first injury in the workplace since I started doing this.
Well, that's not too bad then.
Yeah, I made it almost 5 years.
now the screens on the iMacs, are they still, is it just basically a couple of screws on the top, bottom, and then you're pulling the screen off, or is there adhesive on them now?
The new ones do have adhesive,
do they?
Especially the new thin ones.
Okay.
I think they switched in 2012 or 2013.
Okay.
They started to get thinner, but this was luckily one of the 2011s where it's, you stick a suction cup to the front, pop it off, and then there's six or eight screws, and then the screen just kind of tilts out, and then everything's really easy to get to. So those are a breeze to work on, as long as you don't drop the entire front of the computer.
Right. Yeah. It's amazing how much, you know, a lot of times people will call me and they ask about a screen repair and I'll say it's $149 and they're like, oh, well, I'll call you back. And I know, you know, absolutely they won't. And that's fine. You know, but I'm like going, you know, I try to explain to people, I'm like, you know, if the hard drive, you have the hard drive, the motherboard, and really the screen. And if you look at those in any laptop, you're looking at, You know, depending if you're looking at a $300-$500 machine, you're looking at about a third of the price.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that's really a third. Each one of those parts represents a third of the computer. So yes, if one breaks, it's going to cost you about a third of the price, maybe even a little bit more to get that repaired.
Oh yeah, easily. Yeah.
So, but yeah, so wow, that's fun. So what other types of things do you guys do? I mean, obviously you're doing, you know, hard drive repairs, you know, or as far as swapping them out and doing reinstalls and stuff like that.
Yeah, all the general break fix. You know, we've actually got a pretty neat way for doing reinstalls. And we do a lot of these, not because we can't fix viruses or it's not time, you know, it's not effective to do so. But one of our guys builds Windows images every month, you know, with using SysPrep. And then we have a file server there in the building. So we can actually re-image a machine with all the updates and everything streamlined in. It takes over the network about 20, 25 minutes. And then it takes a few minutes to grab the drivers and Windows 8 and Windows 10 automatically activate now. So if we, you know, anytime we do a reinstall, it's a pretty quick job. So we'd like to really get things in and out as quick as we can, because otherwise you end up with a couple of day long queue.
Right.
So, yeah. So the reinstalls they're pretty seamless nowadays. I haven't touched a CD and I couldn't tell you how long.
No, that's a great idea. And I've thought about that too. I just have not gotten down to the point where I've, you know, been able to take the time and kind of put together a system where I can, you know, build those images. Cause I, you know, I used to do those. And matter of fact, my Slipstream images, my last one of Windows XP Service Pack 3 with all the updates and stuff. I mean, that's how long ago I did my last image.
Oh, wow. So when you do a reinstall, are you doing it from the factory ISO and then updating it from there?
Yep. Usually I'm either, if the hard drive's good, I'm usually only doing reinstalls when I'm replacing like a hard drive or something. Other than that, I'm just doing a cleanup on it. So a lot of times what I'll do is, I'd usually use the, if I can, you know, the recovery partition. If not, I just use an ISO, you know, downloaded from Microsoft. And then, yeah, I've got to go through and, you know, I've tried using like the WSUS, you know, updates and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, and to me, it's not any faster than just downloading them directly from Microsoft and just running them.
Yeah. It seems that way.
So
we had a WSUS server set up for a little while and it, you know, that was back when we were on a 100 megabit switch and it just clogged up the network. And
okay,
you know, we had to switch the IP addresses to point to it and everything, and it was just sort of a mess. But nowadays we use Clonezilla since it's free.
Okay.
He builds the images on a server in virtual machines, using I think he uses Proxmox as the front end.
Okay.
Builds them every month. He boots them up, updates them, and then reruns SysPrep. And then dumps those to a file server, and then we have Clonezilla on the file server. So then you just do a pixie boot to that, pick your image, and then walk away. And then next thing you know, it's in Windows, it's got all the updates done, and it's just, you know, waiting for a product key or a few drivers, and you're out the door.
That's great. No, that's a great way to turn those around.
Yeah, yeah. So and it seems to be a lot more or a lot quicker, at least, than doing a factory install and doing 2 days worth of Windows updates and. You know, we at the volume of stuff, the volume we move, it's not, you know, it's not really practical for us to do it that way.
Oh, so. No. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. When you're working in a shop and you got people coming in all the time, you got to do that where, you know, some of us that are working out of our homes, we're kind of sitting back and going, yeah, it'll be done when I get it done.
Yeah. Give me a few days. No problem.
And, you know, in the way I always look at it is, you know what? Here's the bottom line. If you were to take it to Staples or Best Buy or wherever, you're looking at it probably a week to 2 to 3 weeks to get your computer back. So a couple days. Yeah. I know it sucks being without your computer, but you know, again,
well, you know, we generally run a couple of days in the queue also, you know, even as quick as we do things.
Okay.
We do a pretty large volume. So we generally, we're anywhere from 1 to 4 days behind and during holidays and stuff, we get as far as a week behind.
Right.
That's 60 or 70 machines in line. And
that's a lot.
Yeah, we stay busy, and that's just our branch. The other two branches, you know, they're not quite as busy, but yeah, we're always a few days behind.
Now, so when you're doing that type of stuff, do you do any type of virus removals, or do you just kind of, hey, this is really gunked up, we're going to go ahead and do a clean install on it?
No, we'll do virus removals quite a bit. That's they're pretty profitable usually. So,
Okay.
you know, we set up the system. One thing that we've done that really streamlined it was when we bring in a computer, we'll check it in and we'll kind of give the customer the spiel. If it's less than $100, we'll go ahead and fix it and let you know what it was. If it's more than that, we'll call you and give you a quote and we'll run through everything with you. But conveniently, a virus removal is priced right at $100.
Oh,
So
okay.
if we need to do that, we can do that. If you know if they've got data they don't want to lose or software, we'll clean the machine up. And of course, like you, when you do a virus removal, you do the whole cleanup deal at the same time.
Oh,
So
yeah.
yeah, but most people, you know, we find a lot of times nowadays they don't have any data on the machine. It's everything's in the cloud, or they just got Microsoft Office, which is no big deal to reinstall. So we'll just do a fresh install, and the machine ends up running quite a bit better that way anyway.
Right. Yeah,
So.
you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you guys almost have special customers because I, you know, I'm still, my average customer has between 30 and 80 gigs of data. And a matter of fact, I just pulled a machine apart that the hard drive was dying, and I was a little concerned because he had 300 and actually had more than that, but he had 355 gigs that I had to pull out. And when I looked at the hard drive, it was a 650 gig hard drive. It was almost full, had like 34 gigs of space left. There was a Seagate backup on the desktop. I'm just like going, how did this happen? And no, I don't think this customer had any backups outside of that. And I'm like going, there, if this was all gone, all your pictures, everything would be gone. So when he comes back, I'm gonna have to talk to him about, you know, doing some sort of backup or, you know, seeing what he's doing just to let him know, hey, if this happens and, you know, and I almost to the point where I might not have been able to get the data back. I wasn't able to get it to boot up. I finally, you know, I slaved it to a machine that I have sitting here and I was able to get it to go and able to get it to run enough to get the stuff pulled down. And, I was
Well,
like,
I
whew.
recently had one like that too. It was an old XP machine that was repurposed as a file server, and of course it was in a business. And yeah, their only backup was Carbonite, and no one had maintained it or looked at it in several years, and they were on a home account,
Okay.
and they had managed to back up over a terabyte onto their Carbonite. So when the drive died, you know, when it finally stopped spinning, the only backup they had was that Carbonite. And so I've spent the past 14, 15 days on the phone and emailing and chatting with Carbonite trying to get this data back, and finally managed to get them switched over to a pro account so we can get a drive mailed out.
Yes.
But I know exactly what you mean. It's frustrating when people have all this stuff and they, you know, they don't take the precautions to actually maintain it or think about what happens when it goes south.
Well, and nobody cleans their stuff up. So, you know, I maintain some stuff right now where, you know, it's like you've got duplicates of files that people are trying to work in and share amongst themselves. And it's like, okay, somebody's got to go in. I said, I'm not deleting this stuff. Somebody actually needs to go in and look and see what they're actually using for their business and get rid of the rest. I said, if not, I said, the chances are something's going to get missed along the way as far as being backed up or whatever. You got to have, you know, you've got to know what you're looking at. And, you know, we can only guess at what we can see, right?
And it generally it's the same stuff. Everybody's got pictures, everybody's got some resumes and documents and that kind of stuff. But every once in a while, you've got that customer that had a picture of their dead dog buried under the D drive, you know, and you miss that kind of thing.
Right.
So, yeah, I recently started using FABs auto backup since you guys talk about it so much on the shows, and it's worked out really well. I've not had any issues with that.
Yeah, it's I'll tell you what, I've used it for years and I've never had it. Now, I used to back in the day, I actually used to do a manual backup and use FABs because I just wasn't sure about FABs, but I'm telling you, I have used that time and time again, and it backs the stuff up no problem, gets all the stuff that's actually needed. As a matter of fact, probably even too much stuff sometimes. And a lot of times when I put the stuff back on, it's if I've done a clean install, I will actually, instead of re-importing everything, I kind of drag and drop the important things back over. Then I'll keep a copy of the backup for, you know, a couple weeks, and I'll just let the customer know, hey, go through your stuff, make sure everything's there. As soon as that's done, then, you know, I'll go ahead and delete that image or whatever and go from there. Because there's just, you know, there's a lot that gets, you know, clogged up in the app data folder and all that kind of stuff. And it backs all that stuff up.
Yeah, the backups are pretty large from that I've noticed. We've got a couple of terabytes filled on the file server right now of customer backups, and we delete them after 30 days.
Okay.
But yeah, we kind of have to. And without adding more storage, we're going to have to start deleting them sooner because, you know, people have movies and like you said, the app data gets so clogged up full of garbage. Yep. So, yeah.
Very cool. Now, you said that you more do the managed service type things.
That's more of where I'm taking the business. I went from technician. I was hired in 2012 to lead technician, and then I recently got promoted to the manager of this branch back in earlier this year. So I'm moving everything, kind of not away from residential, but residential is less of a focus. We've got a lot of long term business customers that would have always just called us hourly. You know, come out, this is broken, and you know, I've been listening to Podnuts here for a couple of years, and it seems like everybody else is going this direction also. It's just it's better for both parties to have them on a sort of a managed plan. You know, they know what they're paying. We know what we're fixing. We can get familiar with everything. So I've really focused more on the business to business side, and you know, worked on monthly plans and that sort of stuff. And I'm using a Max Focus. I think that's what.
Okay.
You used to use, right? You and Chris.
Yep. Yeah. I used to use that, and then I used Enable for a while. Now I'm going to be switching everything over to Ninja RMM.
I hadn't heard of Ninja. We looked at Enable and LabTech and Max Focus a few months ago, but Enable and LabTech were so expensive.
Yeah.
It seemed like, you know, their minimum price was far higher than we wanted to really get into it. You know, just starting out with it. So Max Focus seemed like the way to go, or GFI or whatever they want to call it today.
Right.
But they recently changed theirs too. So now, before it was a $50 minimum, but now it's a $50 minimum plus all of your clients that you have on there.
Right.
So that makes it slightly less appealing because now it's a lot closer in price to LabTech and Enable. So we might be migrating later this year.
Yeah. You know, my problem with any of those was not, there was nothing wrong with Max Focus, or there was nothing, you know, other than the learning curve on, LabTech or, any of those other ones.
Yeah.
My problem was, to me, for what I was looking at, they just seemed too complicated. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at them and I go, okay, if I can't assess, if I'm looking at 500 endpoints and I can't assess what's going on, mm-hmm. I don't have a person, you know, here's the thing for me. I don't have a person that's going to sit there and stare at a screen and go, oh yeah, we got this going on. We got this going. No. I need red, green, yellow. Let me know if I need to actually do something. If not, I don't need all the extra information that they provide. So I was looking at something that looked more, I don't even know if I want to say web-based, but that's basically what Ninja RMM is doing for us. I looked at it. I've got it hooked up on several machines right now, testing it out. And it just, I look at it, it's easy to look at, and I can see what I got going on immediately. And if I need to deal with anything, I can. They've got a great, deal with TeamViewer on there. That, you know, TeamViewer is, I think it was $25 a month, and you can use it on unlimited endpoints and also three consecutive, sessions outside of that.
So have you started using Ninja at all? I mean, is it, do you find that it's better than Max Focus? Because we're having pretty good luck with Max Focus. We've had a few issues with the TeamViewer add-on, but they don't give you any kind of limitations like three concurrent sessions or anything. And like you said, everything is pretty much, red or green. It's pretty straightforward.
It is. It's just, it almost seemed like, even when I was looking at the Max Focus stuff, it just seemed like there was just a little bit too much information, even more than what I needed to look at. Like I like a system that I can dig down into if I need to, but if I don't, I just need the basics. Show me the basics. So,
fair enough.
When I was using some of those, it, you know, even the GFI and stuff like that, it just seemed like it was, I couldn't just get a basic overview where I could go, yep, looks good. I had to sit there and go, oh, okay, what's that say? And so that's why I was looking for something a little bit different. And, you know, quite honestly, at the time, Max Focus was changing their pricing. And I don't understand this. You know, everybody's changing their pricing and they want to keep up with the Joneses and all that kind of stuff. And I understand it's a cost for businesses. But part of my problem is you need to tier your business as far as I'm concerned. If you want to charge more per endpoint to have some of the littler guys be able to come in and use your service, then do that.
Yeah.
Don't just go, hey, here's the minimum. and then here's another minimum. And, you know, because we're adding all these features, that here's the thing that a lot of people are not going to use.
No, you'd have to spend so much time with these to utilize all these features. And that was the main thing that kept us from going with LabTech. We went pretty far with them as, you know, as far as getting it set up, but with the minimum pricing, and then you had to sit down with a team of skilled, specialized engineers to learn how to use it, and, you know, to get all the technicians on board and to get everybody trained up with that, it was really just overwhelming and it seemed unnecessary. Especially for what it costs a month. I know most of these companies don't want you to speak about the pricing, so I won't say anything as, you know, about what it costs. But right. MaxFocus is an order of magnitude cheaper than LabTech or Enable or any one of those other big guys. Yep. So, you know, if you've got several hundred or thousand endpoints, maybe those are a better option. But for a break-fix shop or somebody with a few hundred clients, I think MaxFocus is probably the way to go. But I just Googled the Ninja RMM. I'll look into that. I haven't looked into that so far.
Yeah, hopefully we're going to have Armando was our point of contact with that company, and we actually saw him at Channel Pro in Chicago, and hopefully I'm going to get him get a chance to have him come on the show and actually share about you know, what they're offering. They're not doing an official launch until October 1st, I think, but you can get in, and I actually have a meeting with them on October 2nd to kind of have one of their guys run us through all the things that you can do with their system. And that's just kind of give us a run around. I kind of figured some things out on my own, dug around it a little bit, and it seemed, again, there was, you know, I was working with John Dubinsky, and, you know, he was able to, you know, I had a couple questions for him because he's rolling it out to a lot more customers, and it just seemed to work. And I was able to make it work for what I needed for right now. So,
well, it looks interesting. You know, make sure you talk about it on the future show. So I'd like to hear what your thoughts are on it, because if it's, you know, priced competitively with MaxFocus, and maybe it's a better interface, because, you know, let's face it, MaxFocus's interface is not the strong point. So
no,
even on a really fast internet connection on an i7 machine, it still runs a little sluggish in our opinion.
Yeah. And that's, it to me is just too much information that I don't need to see right at the get go.
So. Yeah, I think that's part of it. You know, we've only got a few dozen endpoints, well, maybe a little more than that, but it seems like it is a little slow to respond sometimes. But, and it's got its limitations, so I'm definitely open to moving everybody to something else. But
The one thing is none of them are perfect. You know, John's ran into a couple of problems that we're talking about that they're aware of, and they're going to fix. And this is just the way it is when you get started, or even you've been in the business for a while. So hopefully, you know, it's going to do what we need it to do. But again, I think in it, it's competitively priced with MaxFocus. I think it's just going to come down to, I'll say this, in a more, you know, endpoints you get on there and stuff like that, it's going to give you a better, you know, even cheapen the price a little bit more.
Better deal. Yeah. one more thing I want to touch on kind of briefly, not in relation to MaxFocus or anything, but we do offer hardware leasing to some of our clients, and that's worked out unbelievably well.
Okay.
We've got a couple of doctor's offices and I think one attorney. I'd have to check. Basically, they've been longtime customers for us, and they're small to medium business. They've probably got between 5 and 10 workstations. So they came to us, and you know, we're constantly doing break-fix jobs and going out and fixing this and fixing that printer and this thing and that thing. One of our technicians, one of my main guys that does most of my engineering, if you would, came up with a plan to do some leasing. So we actually lease them the hardware, the software, the printers, the everything IT, and they pay one flat monthly cost. And then after 24 months, we go in, take all their machines out, give them all brand new machines, and they continue with the same monthly cost. And they love that because they're able to write some of that off on their taxes. So it ends up being a much more predictable, you know, expense for them. And then they don't have to worry about the future of their IT needs. And that's worked out great. It's, you know, suffice it to say, it's extremely profitable.
Oh, yeah, I can definitely see that. And plus, you know that equipment like the back of your hand, because it's the stuff you're dealing with all the time.
Yeah.
You're not having to figure out, hey, this person bought an HP and that there's a desktop Dell over there. And, you know, it's like, no. Here's what you get. Everything's the same. Oh, yep. It's bad. you know, you call the leasing company up, hey, send me another one out, or, you know, part, whatever.
Yeah. And all of our leasing customers are within 10 miles of our local shop here. So we've actually never had a service call, or we've never had to go out. We kind of overbuilt the machines when we spec them out. And the nice thing is, even when we get the machines back into, you know, it's, we're coming up on our 2-year expiration date, I think in November. But all the hardware is still under warranty. So
Nice.
Spent a little more up front, but now we're going to be able to refurbish these machines and sell them and make the money on the monthly recurring revenue. And then we're going to have a nice bump from refurbing and selling the hardware next month.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's working out great. So I'm really trying to move that into my other two stores. If we can find some clients that are willing to take on the monthly expense, you know, a lot of them really want to wing it. And, you know, a lot of people still want the break fix model. They just want to, I'll pay you $100 an hour. Just, I don't want to pay you until something breaks. So of course we've got those clients like everybody else, but you know, the people that are getting the best experience are the ones that want to invest a little bit in their company, and everything is just turnkey. So,
yeah, you know how you deal with those customers. You basically go, "Oh, yeah, that's broke. Yeah, well, you know, you go in, you grab it. Yeah, I'll give you a call and let you know when it'll be back. Wait, yeah. I can't be without that. Well, yeah, you should have spent a little more money then.
I've got a contract you can sign here. You know,
exactly.
I don't want to hold your ransom, but this is definitely a better deal for both of us. And you know, I've noticed that a lot of companies don't want to get on board until something does hit the fan.
Right. Exactly.
It's unfortunate because, you know, you could save everybody a lot of time and money if you'd get your ducks in a row before it, you know, went south. But a lot of people, just like residential people with their backups, they don't realize how important they are until they don't have them anymore.
Right.
So yeah, that's just one of those things. But yeah, my business is probably right now 70-30 commercial residential. And I'm trying to skew that a little more commercial.
Okay.
We've got, I think seven or eight technicians full time. We've got three managers, a regional manager, and then the owner of the company. And then we've got a couple of secretaries and that kind of stuff. So we're not a huge company, but we've been around for 19 years now. So I'm hoping that in the future, moving more towards commercial will help us go for another 19 years.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I started to look into a lot more business, especially with what I'm doing, and I'll do a fair amount of that, you know, as time comes up. But I still have this thing where I really want to help out the residential customer. So I, you know, with this Ninja RMM and a couple things we're doing, I made a couple packages, and just two that I'm going to offer to them. And basically the one is going to be $10 a month, and it's going to be your basic, you know, manage antivirus, Windows patch management, third-party patch management, simple cleaning temp files, stuff like that on a regular basis, and go from there. And then if you want backup, what I'm going to do is I'm going to offer the Carbonite backup with that, but the Carbonite backup, it'll be the middle tier, not the basic home one, where it's online backup. And that way I can sell them a 1 terabyte hard drive or whatever that they plug in their computer, and it does a mirror image backup locally. And then also their unlimited, online backup for $20 a month. And it still puts a fair amount of profit in my pocket, even with the prices that I'm paying, that hopefully it'll make sense for me. And, you know, most of the machines I probably won't ever have to touch. But a lot of them, if, you know, I start to see a problem, at least I can let the customer know ahead of time. And what I explain to people is they'll always ask me, well, how can I stop from getting infected? And I say, you can't. I said, but here's what we can do here's the best thing we can do to stop most of the things from coming in. And we need to manage this and see what it's doing on a regular basis. And if you'll let our software do that, you'll be in a much better position where if you do get infected, I can go in a few minutes, clean it up. Versus the time, you know, it doesn't take me that long to do a virus removal anymore, but just the time of, you know, going, by the time you get the viruses that are malware out, and then you look at it and you go, okay, this broke like several Windows things. Now I got to fix those. You know, you go in and you fix all that stuff. You can get it running back to the way it was supposed to be, and it's not a big deal, but it's like I tell customers, don't you want this to run like the day you brought it home from the store 365 days a year? If you want that, then you're going to have to pay a little bit of money. Okay. It's one's a couple lattes, one's four lattes a month. I mean, that's it, you know?
Yeah, I understand that. Let me ask you this then. I like the idea of the monthly recurring revenue. So far, we've only offered that commercially. We don't offer that residentially. How do you deal with the invoicing every month? How do you collect payment on that? Because for us, it seems like, you know, with us having full-time office staff and we use QuickBooks, of course, unfortunately, billing somebody every month for $10 and then trying to collect that payment doesn't really seem worth it. So what are you doing to collect payment that doesn't cause you a lot of overhead and a lot of headache?
John, that's a great question, and I'm glad you asked me.
Well, I want to know the answer, so let's hear it.
So basically, I actually charge them per year.
That's a secret. Okay.
I don't let anybody, because here's the thing. A lot of times, what I'll do is initially right now, if you bring it to me, I will go ahead and I'm basically going to give you, if you sign up for either one of my plans, I'm basically going to give you a virus removal cleanup included in that first year.
So you can afford to just give that job away like
yep.
that.
And then what I'll do is I'll turn around. I'll still put them on a recurring payment, but it'll be a recurring payment once a year. And then
do you keep their card information on file, or do you send them an invoice? Oh, really?
I keep their card. So there's a couple ways I can do it, and I've gone back and forth. So I could set up recurring payments on Stripe if I wanted to. But what I'm thinking about doing, just so it stops, you know, people going, well, I didn't want that or whatever. What I'm going to do is in Repair Shopper, I can actually send an automated recurring invoice out during the time that it needs to go out. It goes out to them. And then, you know, if I don't hear anything back from them, obviously they know, hey, this is coming out. And then I can basically, I do have their card on file. I can charge it right on the spot and go from there. And then at least they know.
So you use Stripe for that for storing their credit cards and everything?
Yep.
Okay. So we don't have a good way to do that. You know, surprisingly enough, for a company of our size, we rely pretty heavily on QuickBooks, and there are a lot of features of QuickBooks that we don't use that we really should be looking into. But I did use Repair Shopper for a few months. That was one of my first projects when I took over, was move from a paper based check-in system,
right?
Which I've reverted to temporarily, but Repair Shopper, the API that Intuit gives these companies to put the data in QuickBooks is horrendous, to say the least. And we had tons and tons of problems every day with the transactions from Repair Shopper getting sent into QuickBooks. And in order for my bookkeeper and my accountant to keep us in business every year, you know, we've got to give them QuickBooks files. Repair Shopper doesn't have enough tools to make it work for them. So the problem I was having was every day there was problems with the dates being messed up or the amounts not totaling out properly. So I ended up having to abandon Repair Shopper and go back to paper because it seemed to work the best with QuickBooks.
Okay.
But yeah, I've looked into Nick Shaw's PC Repair Tracker. One of our stores uses that right now, and they've had good luck with it. Okay. So I'll probably roll that out, you know, through all three stores. But regrettably, we did have to move away from Repair Shopper. But
yeah,
it's interesting hearing that you use Stripe. I never thought about using Stripe for online payments.
And I never, you know, so from this standpoint, now I haven't heard of any other people having problems in QuickBooks, but I will tell you, I actually still do all my finances through Excel. So I don't have that integrated in there. The stuff that I do use in Repair Shopper works very, very well for me, and I haven't had any problems. But I have been... One of my goals in 2016 is actually to move over to, QuickBooks or something along those lines.
God have mercy on you.
I know.
That's all I can say.
I don't want to because I use Quicken right now for my own personal finances and I hate it. And it's still manual operation.
I do Excel for my personal finances, which it works great. You know, but it's simple. You know, we've got, I don't have any kids. It's not a big deal. But in the business, you know, we're a multi-million dollar company.
Right.
You can't get by without something full-fledged.
Oh, yeah. You have to. There's no way.
And Repair Shopper, I kind of blamed it on Intuit for what the tools that they give companies like Repair Shopper, because the QuickBooks web connector was always breaking.
Okay.
And it was just constantly a problem. And I can't abandon QuickBooks, so I did have to abandon Repair Shopper. But I really liked it, you know, as far as functionality.
Oh, yeah.
I wish that it was locally hosted. I didn't like that it was on the cloud because it was a little sluggish sometimes. But
okay. Yeah.
Other than that, yeah.
See, I've moved to this stuff for myself. And again, it's different because I'm a one man shop. I don't want to host anything. Mm-hmm. I want everything to be out there in the cloud. So it doesn't matter if my whole house blows up, I can go grab a laptop and, you know, I'm still in business. It doesn't matter, you know?
That's the way to do it.
So for me, in just because I don't want to make sure that, oh, that's, you know, I want somebody else to work on that back end and go, yeah, all this stuff's being backed up. Yeah, all this stuff's being, you know, catered to, and I don't have to worry about it. So,
yeah, I would prefer to do it that way, but sometimes it's just, it's easier and it's quicker and definitely cheaper to host it yourself. So we've got a couple of file servers and some other stuff that we use, you know, for, like I said, the monthly virtual machines that we do. And we also host email for a couple of clients, and we host one or two websites. So nothing major, but it is nice to have the stuff on premises just for responsiveness and the affordability of it once you pay for the hardware.
Well, you know, it's funny because even using Repair Shopper, and they've got some cool features where you can go to my website and basically sign in. Customer can sign it with their mouse or whatever, and it's kind of cool. Mm. But the thing is, for me, is there are times when I'm going to a customer's home that I don't have a great cell signal wherever they're at. And, you know, my cell signal in my house is fine, but I could be out and about and it goes in and out wherever. So what I've done and what I still do, even if you come to my house, I actually still do paper invoices.
So, hey, I don't blame you.
The paper sign-in sheet. So basically work orders, I'll hand them to the customer, go fill out the section in blue, turn it over, read and sign the back. And then I've got that inked copy on file. What I'll do is I'll come back up to Repair Shopper, input that customer's information. Then if they come back to me, which a lot do, you know, then I can go in there and go, hey, just, you know, jot your signature here. Okay, me to work on this machine again. Okay, great. And so it simplifies the process from that standpoint, but I'm still initially a little bit old school and do the paper copy.
Yeah, I am too, honestly. You know, I'm still young, but paper, it is easy. You know, it is. Now it's hard when you need to go back and find something. You know, if you've got a client that comes back 6 months or a year later, now you've got to go through a file for it, try to find the paperwork, which it's a pain in the neck. But that happens so infrequently that it's not really a huge concern.
Well, so the other thing I liked too was what I was finding out is a customer call me, and it could be 6 months down the road, and they go, hi, remember me? You worked on such and such. And I'm like going, you know, and I have no idea who back there. I'm like, I really don't. It's like, you know, I'd love to, you know, remember exactly who all my customers, but I don't remember exactly what machines I worked on for who. So it's kind of one of those things where, you know, they're like, yeah. But what's nice is I can be at my computer and log in and look at the, you know, type in their name and boom. Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, we fixed that for you, blah, 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 and kind of move on from there. So that aspect of it. So I guess, you know, for me, as a one-man shop, I use a hybrid approach, which seems to work fine. So right now.
In your situation, I think Repair Shopper is definitely the best by far. And their costs are pretty reasonable.
Yeah.
But it didn't work out for us.
Right.
This QuickBooks thing.
Well, now you're making me. So now I'm going to have to talk to those guys and make sure that, you know, QuickBooks is going to work for what I need it to work for.
Well, I mean, they were great. Repair Shopper support was fantastic.
Oh, yeah, they are.
Every time we called, you got somebody on the phone pretty much instantly. And, you know, we never had any issues with them. And I hated to cancel, but it wasn't working.
Now, were you using the regular full version of QuickBooks, or were you using like QuickBooks Online?
No, we use QuickBooks Pro 2015 on the desktop, you know.
See, I'm gonna try the online because, again, I don't want to mess with that big overbloated machine that's QuickBooks.
It's not as bad as you think. There are a couple of quirks to it, but we've got I've got QuickBooks installed on three machines in my office personally.
Okay,
and it's rare that we have an issue. You know, one machine hosts the company file, the other two access it over the network, and works fine.
Okay. And that's, you know, and because I've got so many different, you know, I've got so many different bank accounts running and stuff, and even my business stuff, I use Quicken, and I still have to manually go in, even after downloading my bank file stuff, and fix it. So it's like, I still manually, you know, yeah, it'll show me where the errors, you know, not really show me. I got to find out where the duplications that went in for whatever reason. And again, it's probably nothing to do with Quicken. It probably has something more to do with, well, Quicken is, even Quicken's bloated. It on my Core i7 with 32 gigs of RAM, it still stalls sometimes. And I'm like going, are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous in this day and age.
But overall, I think it probably has to do more with, you know, the way that bank is sending the information down. It's just not lining up right. So,
yeah. And that was the problem we had.
Right. So that makes sense. Yeah. So what are some of the favorite tools in the shop, software or hardware wise?
Hardware wise, we've got those iFixit screwdriver sets, which are fantastic. We bought a couple of those a couple of years ago. And they're all still in perfect condition. Those are definitely my go-to tool. We didn't buy the whole iFixit kit thing. It's like $65. We just bought the screwdriver kits on Amazon, and they're $25, $30.
Right.
But they're really great quality. So we've got a couple of those kicking around. Software-wise, we've been playing around with that Tron script from Reddit. It works pretty well as far as automating a virus removal. It takes an extremely long time, which is annoying. But if we do have a few virus removals, we'll take a section of the workbench there, line them up, and start Tron, and then kind of let them go overnight.
Oh, okay.
When you come in the morning and they're all finished, and you just kind of double check. So that works pretty well for some free software at least.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and, I've heard a couple of people talk about that. I have not had a chance to try it out myself. So I mean, what does it do basically?
It's like, think of Ian's Tech Waru software,
right?
From Repair Tech. I had that for a while and I used it, but it was a little too clunky, to be honest. Ian's a great guy; they make some great software, but it just seemed to be simpler to do it manually for the volume of virus removals that we were doing.
Okay,
so we went back to doing it manually for a while, and then we found Tron, and it's essentially the same thing that TechWaro does. It lines up all these tools and then just kind of runs them. It runs them all in silent mode so that they don't require any interaction on the technician side. So there's very little keyboard time involved.
Okay.
And then it does the whole disk cleanup, disk defrag, all that garbage too.
Gotcha.
Okay. So pretty much a whole tuned up in a box there. But the downside being, I've seen some of them take 10 to 14 hours to run.
Oof. Wow.
Yeah. So you've really got to have the time to set it in the corner and let it go and do its thing.
Now, it's funny because that's how I used to do virus removals, is throw a bunch of scans in it. It would take me anywhere from 8 to 16 hours. It wasn't a lot of time on keyboard or anything like that, but it was just like, I'm just running scan after scan after scan. And my machines were clean. They ran great. And they got back to the customer. But I'm like, after a while, I'm going, I think I'm running some redundant programs here that are basically what I've ended up finding out was they're not finding anything. They're not really doing anything. So I really streamlined my process to get down, using Ken Dwight's method from virus doctor. And it's night and day difference. I'm like, I get the same results literally a tenth of, not even that, probably a tenth of the time, so.
Yeah. I did one or two of his, conference deals there, and that guy definitely knows his stuff.
Yep.
But virus removals nowadays, it's either we try to automate it the most we can, or we'll actually sit down and take the time to do it manually.
Yep.
But there's not a lot of in between on that.
No. Yeah. I do some certain things with just getting some of the stuff up. But really, the only two scans I actually run out of machines anymore is Malwarebytes and
Adware Cleaner.
No, I don't even run those anymore because it seems like Malwarebytes was getting everything out that I needed it to do. But the TDSS killer, I've never come across a rootkit yet. So
really,
yet.
We did that for a while with that that Powlix virus. That was pretty mean.
And
then ESET came out with a tool that just cleaned it right up, no problem. So I still got that on all the flash drives just in case. But
absolutely.
We use TDSS killer, but it's so rare that it picks something up a lot of times we don't bother.
The only reason I run it, it's so silly, but it's so fast that it's like,
You might as well. Yeah.
It's there. It's in my tool set. And I use D72 or, TechWaru or whatever, and it just runs. But a lot of those other tools, I don't run as many scans as I used to. I think a lot of times is once the infection's gone, whether it be malware, there's really not a whole lot of viruses anymore, but once the malware and stuff is gone, it's usually broken Windows in some form or fashion, and that's where you got to go in and figure out, okay, I use D72 and it resets a lot of my main settings. I usually clear the browsers, even though a lot of people go, oh, I can't do that to my customer. I tell them, hey, listen, something's wrong with this browser. I don't know what to tell you. It was messed up. So all
too
I can tell you
about it. Yeah,
I cleared it out. Yeah, you're gonna have to remember those passwords to put them back in. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, that's one reason I really like ADW Cleaner, because everybody nowadays lives in a browser. You know, everything.
Yeah.
The passwords are saved. Their logins are saved. The cookies are saved. And when they get the ads or the redirects or their shortcut gets modified, so it changes their homepage, that kind of stuff, and AdWord Cleaner is really quick. It takes 5 minutes, and it knocks out the vast majority of that right off the bat. So on a lot of those jobs, we'll run that right up front just to make sure that the browsers are, you know, where they need to be.
You know, it's funny because the one thing I didn't like about ADW Cleaner was the fact of that I had to go back into the control panel and go to add remove programs to get rid of the leftover, you know, even though it's like this has already been removed. But it was still in there, and I'm like going, okay, this is kind of silly. I'm getting, I could have gone in here and just done a, you know, massive uninstall, you know, whatever, using deuninstaller or something like that. And I'm like, so that, and what I was finding out is there was still some things that were sticking in the browsers.
Yep. And we've had that problem too.
And so what I was end up doing, I end up going in and hard resetting the browsers. And here's the problem. Even if the customer wasn't using IE and I was having some sort of a redirect or whatever in Chrome or Firefox, what I ended up finding out was even though I had cleaned those out, it was still an IE, and IE is still tied into these other browsers in some form or fashion in the Windows operating system. So what was happening is, that proxy setting was still there and just, you know, would send it right to wherever it needed to go. And I'm like, wow, okay, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, you'd think that they would find a better way to do that than let IE's proxy settings override it.
I don't know. It's, you know.
Unfortunately not. So that's a really common issue. And it's really annoying when you get the ones that you uncheck the proxy box and then you leave the window and it goes right back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had a few of those here lately.
Got to go in and know I really want to delete this.
Yeah, I'm positive, I promise you.
Oh, very cool. iFixit tools, that's cool. I have the iFixit tools and I use it for when I, you know, I have certain bits and stuff like that, but my main screwdrivers, I actually like the Felo, F-E-L-O. They're German screwdrivers, basically. And
Germans make great stuff, yeah.
It's there you go. One of the things is I just like how the handles are built, and I've had them for so many years. And, you know, I basically pulled stripped-out screws out of computers, and these things are still like they're brand new.
Yeah, that's how we feel about the iFixit ones. We've got three or four of those kicking around, and we've never lost a bit. None of them have ever stripped. And They've got all the bits for every, you know, like I said, we do a lot of mobile devices and odds and ends and that kind of stuff. And we've never run into something that the iFixit kit didn't have a bit for.
I'll tell you, I might be getting a little bit old because, you know, I'm sitting here looking at, you know, what I do with a hand screwdriver. And I'm like going, you know, for $100, I could get a nice little DeWalt, you know, stand up drill that basically will pull this stuff out as many times as I do it.
We've got two of those too. Yeah, we use those for desktops and printers and that type of stuff. But for anything laptop and smaller, you don't really want to use a 12-volt drill. So,
gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But beyond that, you know, a couple of 128 gig flash drives with some tools on them are the most valuable things that we have. And then, of course, you know, our servers and that type of stuff. But as far as actual tools go, the iFixit things are our go-to.
Now, let me ask you a question. Do you guys use lockable flash drives, or are you just kind of?
No, I did. I had some of the Kangaroo with the right lock on them.
Yep.
But nowadays with USB 3 and gigabit Ethernet, if I suspect the drive is infected, I just nuke it, reload everything to it.
Gotcha.
To the server, and then it's not a big deal. But yeah, the Kangaroo ones are a little expensive, and I haven't looked at them in a while. But we've got a partner relationship with PNY, so we got some of their 128s for a little bit of nothing. So we've got a few dozen of those hanging around, and they're all USB 3. They've got good speeds.
Nice.
So we'll keep a lot of the Windows images on there too. So if the network is getting bogged down and we've got to do a reinstall, we can do everything from USB 3.
Gotcha. Yeah, I went back and again, a little bit old school. I've been using disks and still using disks. I know.
No. I'll send you these images. The guy that builds these, the main technician for us that makes these, actually wrote up an entire guide, step-by-step on how to do it.
Oh, I'd love to see that, just to see what went into producing something like that. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I'll send you the PDF, and I'll send you maybe the images are kind of large. You know, they're a couple of gigs, so I don't know. I'll host one and send you a link to FTP it or something.
Okay, all right, that'd be great. Yeah, I look at a lot of this stuff. So I went in and I bought a bunch of little 8 gig flash drives that are like waterproof and crush proof and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I got them. Normally they're $17 a piece. I got 10 of them for $50.
That's
so no, it's not. And they're USB 3.0. They're fast, because I use a 32 gig models for transferring stuff back and forth. And what I did was I took a lot of my main tools, because I'll have sometimes, even here in this small place, I'll have 3-4, computers set up where I'm just kind of, plugging stuff in. But what I did was I created all the, just the generic ISOs, and put those on there just so I could have, I could get back. I could either use the tool set that I needed for each of the Windows operating systems, or, if I needed to install Ubuntu or something like that to look at a file system if it was really screwed up and I really couldn't get to it for whatever reason. Just some of those types of things. But yeah, I understand the whole imaging thing is going to be much, much better and much quicker for getting that stuff back on. So I'd really be interested to see, exactly how you put that stuff together and how he's building those. Cause that's.
Yeah. We'll get you converted. I'll make sure that you have no more CDs in your house after this.
Now,
I wouldn't go back to that. Even if they paid double, I wouldn't do it from a CD.
Now, let me ask you a question. So from that standpoint though, because I've ran into a problem where I can't get a USB drive to work. Now is using the Pixie Boot server and stuff like that. Does stuff work pretty much every time?
Yeah, as long as you turn off Secure Boot and turn on the legacy or CSM. Now, honestly, a lot of them I do from USB because it is quicker than Ethernet.
Okay.
Because one of our main switches is still 100 megabit, for the front half of the building.
Okay.
So yeah, doing over the network is kind of slow, but we don't have any issues with, we use Easy to Boot, to make the flash drives bootable. And then we just dump the images into a directory on the flash drive.
See, I must be doing something wrong because I cannot get that to work for. I can't get it. I've had a problem even when I turn Secure Boot off, turn Legacy Boot on. Mm-hmm. I've still had a problem on some, not on every machine, but on some machines, getting the ISOs to boot from a multi-boot, flash drive.
Here's how we do it. And let me be up front here as a disclaimer. I'm not the guy that made this. My primary technician, Matt, is the genius here. I'm just the guy that kind of calls the shots in the building. But
right.
We use Easy to Boot. You boot up to their little environment there on the flash drive. We boot into a CloneZilla image. And then in CloneZilla, you choose your source, which is going to be whatever operating system image you've got. And then your destination, which is the local drive. And so we've had no problems booting into CloneZilla from the flash drive or over the network.
Okay.
But you just have to make sure that you've got Secure Boot and all that other UEFI Windows 8 garbage turned off. And no problems.
Okay, great. No, I'm glad to hear that, because I built an Easy to Boot. And I think at the time I had a smaller drives. I think my largest drive I had to play around with was like a 16 gig. And again, for getting, any type of ISO images on there, that's not a whole lot of space, right? So,
yeah, we've got 128s, but we're going to have to switch to some larger, because we keep images, everything from Vista, Starter, 32-bit, all the way up to Windows 10 Pro 64-bit. So every version in between.
Wow.
well.
No, I'm kidding. I know why. No, I still get.
And you need to do one.
I still get Vista machines every once in a while. Surprisingly enough, I'm getting more Windows 10 machines than I thought I would actually get, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think we're getting every single one. So it really feels that way.
It's like, seriously, you just saw something free and you decided to upgrade it? I don't, do you know what you're doing? No.
No, not a bit. No, we've had people that bought machines from us with Windows 7 specifically because they wanted Windows 7.
Sure.
A week later, I don't know. Somehow it's on Windows 10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know how that happened.
So but it's happened so often, I really don't know if they're doing the Windows update and not realizing it, or if they're just lying to my face and saying that they didn't do it when they did. But it's been very frequent that we've had to do the rollback from 10 to 7 or 8. And it works well. It only takes, 5 or 10 minutes.
That's what I heard, yeah.
Yeah, it's, I don't know how they do it so quick. But
now, I will tell you that, because I basically, when I looked at the file system when I had done an upgrade to the system, it looks like they actually make some sort of image for the previous operating system. And I think they're just, all they're doing is whatever the software they're using. It looks to me like they're putting the image back in the format that it was. So I think that's why it can roll back so easily. But I'm going to tell you right now that your customers are lying, because I've got a Windows 8.1 machine that's sitting here, and it pops up every time I turn the computer on. It says, your Windows up 10, your Windows 10 upgrade is waiting. And it's like, I haven't pulled the trigger because this is my production machine. I've got it on 5 other machines. I'm really nervous about putting it on this one at this point, because I do so much audio and other things. I'm like going, I'm just going to wait a couple more months. And then the other thing too is I actually might get another hard drive and just install it, do the upgrade, install it on that, and have the image of, my Windows 8 system in case I need to go back or whatever.
Yeah, I've got a ThinkPad that runs my Plex on my TV there for my wife.
Okay.
And God help me if that thing goes down.
You'd be in trouble.
Yeah, exactly. So that, it's been nagging me about Windows 10. Every time you open up Internet Explorer, it annoys you. And when you boot it up, it annoys you. But I don't want to touch it. It came with Windows 7. It's going to continue to run Windows 7. It has one job, and I don't think Windows 10 needs to be involved. So,
well, I'll tell you what, yeah, and probably for what you're doing with the Plex server, I would say you're probably right. I will tell you that I have loaded Windows 10 on a 7-year-old laptop. Mm-hmm. And it runs tremendously better on a spinning drive than Windows 7 ever did.
Really?
And it originally came with Windows Vista. And I did a fresh, because I was cleaning up some computers. I did a fresh, it was my wife's old computer. She uses a tablet now. She doesn't really use that laptop. So I said, well, let me go ahead and do an upgrade. So I did a fresh install of Windows 7. Then I went and did, and it's still running like garbage. And I went and ran I did an upgrade of Windows 10, still running like garbage. So then once I did the upgrade, now I feel safe that I can go back in. It's got the information. I can do a fresh install and it'll be fine. So I did a fresh install of Windows 10. That thing runs better than it's ever ran in its entire life.
Yeah. Yeah. The fresh install is definitely going a long way. That's why we lean on that so often.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah, and it's nice, I guess it's got its ups and its downs, but since Microsoft stores the hardware information online, if you need to do a fresh install of Windows 10, you just do the install. You don't have to worry about the licensing or the activation or
exactly
anything like that. It just seems to work.
Yep.
So yeah, that's pretty great.
Yeah. So I you know what? It actually might make our jobs a little bit easier, moving down the road. So
I wouldn't mind it.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's hard. I ran into a couple issues where I had a Dell, and I've got some Dell OEM disks, but they're Dell OEM Windows Professional, Windows 7 Professional.
Yeah.
And this was a Windows 7 Home Premium that was on this machine. Hard drive died. Long story short, I replaced the hard drive, and I go, man, you know what? I'd really like to put the Dell stuff back on here and just, pull the stuff off that I don't need. And not thinking that they would have, I thought they would have the drivers and stuff on there, which they didn't. So I didn't realize this. But what I did was, you're actually able to use the Windows Professional disk and install it. And because it's an OEM activation, it doesn't care. You could do a Windows 7 Home Premium, Windows 7. It doesn't matter. It's like it activated instantly. Boom, done. I added the drivers and I was, off to the races.
That has to be against the terms of use somewhere. But hey,
it probably is. But I'm like going, yeah, okay. I'm not calling you for the OEM. I don't have the window. I have one of two choices. Which, in my opinion, or not my opinion, my understanding is that even when I'm doing a regular, I'm using a clean ISO. Yeah, clean OEM ISO that's not a Dell branded, HP branded, whatever, that even that is not within the terms of service. I've been doing that for so long that I used to get machines in and I would wipe them and I would put the software back, vanilla software back in without all the crud that came along with these operating systems. Problems I've been running into is some of these OSs will have things like, you know, the things that sometimes people do actually like the Dell Dock or, you know, webcam these different software. Webcam software, it's things like that. So that's why I did it in this case, because here's the thing. I tried to make a Windows 7 Home Premium ISO out of that Dell OEM tool, and I couldn't get it to do it.
Yeah, they can be pretty finicky sometimes, but yeah, you know, I plead the fifth here, but yeah, I remember you and Chris talking about the reusing the Windows key on the machine. You know, when you do a fresh install and you just type in the key.
Yeah.
And apparently, you know, we don't do it this way, but apparently, yeah, that's not the way that's supposed to be done.
No, it's not. Which, you know, it kind of floors me because, you know, they say it's not supposed to be done that way, yet they put stickers
with the key on it.
Different. It's not the OEM key. It's actually the key, the license key that is for that particular machine. So I'm like going, how does this actually violate terms of service?
Yeah, what is that for if it isn't for a reinstall?
Right. And I could never figure that out. And you know what? And I never got, you know, a complete answer from anybody that could go, well, here's why it is the way it is.
Yeah. I don't think anybody knows. I think it's all pretty muddled. And that's why I don't think it's really much of an issue. You know, I'm not going to go install a pirated copy of Windows 7 on somebody's Windows Vista laptop. No.
Exactly.
But if somebody comes in with a Windows 7 machine with a legitimate key that you can read on the bottom of it.
Yep.
You know, regardless of what the terms say, morally, I don't see a problem with
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And that's the way I looked at that stuff. It's like, I've had people come in with pirated software, and I basically had to tell them, you know, if they've got a dying hard drive, I'm like going, you're going to have to buy a, you know, licensed Windows 7 key to put back on his computer. Quite honestly, it's going to cost you more to fix this thing than what we can get you actually another, you know, desktop for or whatever. And, you know, a lot of times people are like, oh, you know, because they had somebody build it and they put some generic key on there, and it's like going, yeah. I can't put it back on.
No.
You know, I'm not going to, I can't do that. So, you know, but I feel that if the machine came with a copy of whatever flavor.
Yeah, that was part of the cost of the machine.
Exactly.
Everybody made their money, so I don't see a problem in redoing that.
And the only reason I tried the Windows, the Dell Windows 7 Professional Dell on there was because I remember back in the day when we would order Dell computers, what would end up happening is we would get several disks. And what was weird is we would have disks for Home Premium, Professional. And then even when they had the problem where people wanted XP and they were, you know, kind of going to 7 or they had 8 and they wanted to roll it back to. So a lot of times they would have the previous operating system also in a disk that they would send you, you know. So it's.
Well, I remember you and Chris on the other Podnuts show talking about he was doing some refurbishing. I think it was Chris. And, you know, with the we do order the refurbishing keys every month and to go from Vista to 7 or
absolutely
7, wherever you got to go, but they do send you the OEM pre-installation kit, and I've never used it personally. Some of us have used it in our company, but you know, we stick to the Clonezilla images, and it works out great.
There you go.
You still have to provide your own authentication, but nowadays with Windows 8 and even with the Windows 8 with Bing images, we've got those. But they just, you know, during the setup there, they automatically activate and you're off to the races.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's like I said, hopefully it's getting a little bit better.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to get away from paper keys, especially the ones that got too hot and you couldn't read them or, you know, that they sat on the couch for 10 years and now they're rubbed off. And,
exactly.
Yeah. I don't miss that a bit. So,
well, John, I appreciate your time and all the information you've shared with us today. And I'm very interested in some of the things that we talked about, because I'm always interested in this stuff, but as a, you know, sometimes as a one man show, it's hard for me to, you know, take the time to put that stuff together. So.
Yeah, it's hard to find the R&D budget, I like to call it.
Well, yeah. I've got the machine. I could do it. I just don't know. You know, it's like to take the time to learn to do it. It's like,
yeah. How many other things do you have to do before you do that? Yeah.
Exactly. There's other things that seem maybe a little more important. I don't know, but I definitely appreciate you coming out and sharing. I've learned a ton tonight, and you know, appreciate that. So, if people wanted to get in touch with you, what would be the best way to do that?
You can find our company on Facebook, Computer Pros Greenville, GREENEville, or my email personally is John H@computerpros.net. And that's probably the two quickest ways to find me.
Great. Well, again, so, just appreciate you coming out and sharing with us tonight.
Hey, no problem. Happy to do it.
Very cool. Well, you guys can find me on the Google Plus at Jeffrey Hallisch or Twitter at TechNutPC. If you have any questions or would like to be a guest on this show like John was, email me at podnutsdaily@podnuts.com. And I want to thank our sponsor, Instant House Call, for this episode of Podnuts Daily. And don't forget, if you guys need business paperwork to get you started in your computer repair business, then check out the link for the TechNebel Computer Business Kit over at podnuts.com. You too can help support the Podnuts Network. The next time you're shopping on Amazon, go to podnuts.com/Amazon. And I want to thank everyone for listening and subscribing to the show. We'll see you next time on Podnuts Daily. My name is Jeff Hallisch. I am the host of Podnuts, where Chris Carruthers and myself take live calls on the air to answer questions or to get answers from other computer repair techs every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern. You can check it out over at podnuts.com/live. Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.